There's one on every corner.
They make the motorcycle gangs look like go-kart kids. Wild.
And willing.
My soul runs naked with the wind.
Mario, come on, man.
Get lost, huh? Go find your Amazon.
Mr. and Mrs. Finley are here.
To leave the girls and the wild parties alone.
What's your name?
Betty Larson. Betty Larson.
They broke every rule in a swimming pool.
You're the only person that ever did that to me.
Wild.
And willing.
See this difference between woman and a girl.
Lonnie.
You're trembling, Mrs. Finley.
I detest you.
Tell me how much you hate me.
Lonnie, leave me alone.
I hate you. Lonnie, leave me alone.
Keep telling me how much you hate me.
I hate you, Lonnie. Lonnie, leave me alone.
They know what they want, and they aim to get it.
Okay, are we rolling? Good. Forgotten Horrors Podcast, take one. Cue the appropriate music. No. I said the appropriate music. That's more like it. This is Mike Price welcoming you to the Forgotten Horrors Podcast, a blatant exploitation of our new series of Forgotten Horrors movie books. It is my pleasure now to introduce John Woolley, without whom none of this would be possible. And now, the acclaimed author of Soul Soup for the Chickens and others too humorous to mention, John Woolley.
And thank you, as always, Michael H. Price. I'm really happy to be here again to talk about another film that has been, well, it's been lost for a long time, kind of like Private Property that we did a few times ago.
Kind of like Private Property, very much indeed.
And in fact, that doesn't just extend to its lostness, does it? It extends to the attitude of the film and the, I guess, pushing the barriers, which we'll get into.
Ripe for repression.
Yes.
Suppression, mm-hmm. Oppression, mm-hmm. And all those other pressions.
That's right. And especially being what it is, a small film, you know, and we'll talk about this in a little bit, but you start thinking about, we've often talked about the production code seal. The films, you know, that came after 1934 on the films that we discuss. And the production code was really loosening in the time that Rat Fink was made, 1965,
mm-hmm.
because the year before, you know, the production code seal had been granted to the pawnbroker, right?
Right.
The first time partial nudity was awarded a production code seal.
Mm-hmm.
Then the year after Rat Fink, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf got a production code seal. But those were big pictures. Those were studio pictures.
And it took the little studios to point the way.
Right.
And the big studios to say, well, if they got away with it, we sure as hell can.
But, you know, as you've often said, the pioneer is the guy with the arrows in his back.
Oh, is that ever true?
And certainly with stuff like Rat Fink, I suspect it was condemned by the Legion of Decency.
That's a foregone conclusion. I used to keep tabs on that condemned list.
Mm-hmm.
I was in a public school, but there was still the looming influence of the Legion of Decency.
Which was hand in glove, of course, with the production code at that time.
Right. It was like the parasitic watchdog.
Mm-hmm.
Funny how often those outfits would disagree, and the production code might go ahead and grant what they referred to with a straight face as the purity seal.
The purity seal, right.
You know, it's like safe as milk, kids. And then the Legion of Decency would issue its dreaded C rating for condemned.
Right.
Yeah, and it's like, whoa, boy, you're gonna burn if you watch this movie.
That's right.
Yeah, you're gonna burn if you hear an ad on the radio about it.
That's exactly right.
and for God's sake, don't get caught listening to Buddy Knox singing about that party doll.
But you know the thing about it is, the big studios could get away with it a lot better than the small studios could.
I
mean, I think that's a kind of a foregone conclusion because the small studios were equated with schlock, for one thing, and not art. And yet, we're in the, I don't know if it's revisionist history or not, but we start looking at stuff like Rat Fink, and there's some very artistic currents that are moving through that picture.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It was one of the first films to treat rock and roll as an art form.
Mm-hmm. And, yes.
Which was very unusual at the time. Although there were many rock and roll movies, they were mostly exploitive in the top four hit record sense.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Go ahead. We both got things to say about this. You go ahead first, and yes,
I don't think the top 40 responded that favorably to the soundtrack, but the material, you know, that could have any of those songs could have gone into radio play. I always hear Ricky Nelson interpreting some of the material.
My Soul Runs Naked, do you hear him doing that?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
then the ones that Tommy, what was the guy, Tommy Loomis, I guess, was the name of the,
uh-huh.
the rockabilly act that was in the beginning of the picture.
Right, yes.
But My Soul Runs Naked, it may have been a little bit even too hot for, you know, too hot for radio at that time. I don't know.
Well, of course it was, but the people who saw it took the attitude away with them.
Okay. Explain that a little bit more, would you?
I think the film may have been more influential on the pop music scene than on filmmaking or pop culture in general.
Mm-hmm.
You know, very few people got to see it. The two attempted releases were not warmly received.
I didn't realize there were two. There were two. Were they pretty close together?
They were pretty close together in time. I could pretty well. I'm sure I've got the release dates in the files here. But there were two attempted releases. Nobody knew what to make of it. Rat Fink, what is that, a Big Daddy Roth movie?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
and so it had the disadvantage of a title that was maybe exploitable but not readily understood.
Now, wasn't My Soul Run Naked, My Soul Runs Naked used as a title as well in some situations?
I believe that's right.
Yeah. Yeah, which might have been a little bit, then it would have sounded like a porn film, right? I mean, or a skin flick from 65. So there you go.
It was a snake bit picture.
It was.
And yet what a good honest picture.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't run across this, and I didn't do the press interviews with the Coen brothers on Inside Llewyn Davis, the folk music film.
Mm-hmm.
I've always suspected they might have been influenced. by Rat Fink when they made, you know, it's about the small time folk singer who could have been a contender. But he's such a jerk that nobody will take him seriously.
And you know, it's although this has been kind of the case with Elvis, at least for a time in Jailhouse Rock a couple of years earlier, or actually 10 years earlier, I guess.
Quite so.
The idea of the guy being a thorough jerk, which Schuyler Hayden's character is in Rat Fink, was kind of unprecedented. I don't think there'd ever been a rock and roll movie where the protagonist or the main character was such an absolute heel as there is in Rat Fink. Now, I have to tell you, go ahead.
John Landis takes chances.
Yes, James.
Yeah, I'm sorry, James Landis.
James, another Landis.
John, too, but then.
John does, too. You're right, exactly. Yeah.
Lapsus linguae.
Well, I have to tell you a little backstory here. Joey and I have been looking for this film for many years because our friend Bill Boyce, the actor who was the star of The Slime People and did some other stuff, did TV, was almost Jethro Bodine in the Beverly Hillbillies, to hear Bill tell it, who has passed, been gone now. Joey, how long has Bill been gone? It's been about 3 or 4 or 5 years, maybe?
Probably four or five years.
Mm-hmm. And he was always talking about Rat Fink, and he would tell us in his way. He said, you know, he and James Landis were very friendly. He really admired James Landis. He said, one of the smartest guys he ever knew. And they played chess together, he and James Landis, a lot. And he said, James Landis, he put money into The Sadist, the movie The Sadist. Bill put a little of his money into that because Bill was a money actor, and we'll talk about that in a little bit because we did a documentary about him back about 10 years ago that's now getting ready to see the light of day. But Bill did commercials. He said you could be a fame actor or a money actor, and he wanted to be a money actor, so he did commercials and stuff, and he made a lot of money. Well, James Landis was always kidding with him. They were very good friends, and at one time when Rat Fink was getting ready to be made, James Landis says to him, well, Bill, you think you can play any part in this new film of mine? And Bill says, yes, I can play a part. I can play any part. What do you want me to play? And Bill said he wanted me to play a sissy. Now, Bill was this big old, you know, ex-military, little Rose Bowl football player, Golden Gloves boxer guy. And he took the challenge, and he said, I had to play a sissy. And I said, well, we're going to find this film, because at that point, you couldn't find it. And Bill says, well, I hope you don't, because I played a sissy. He was very, very, very ambivalent about finding the picture. Well, the upshot of it is, I believe he told me at one point he was a hairdresser in the picture. And there is a jump cut, if you remember, from the time that the manager discovers Schuyler Hayden's character. And then there's like this cut jump, and all of a sudden he's a singing star. And I suspect at one point there was a thing in there where they were making him over. And Bill Boyce was probably in that part. But Bill is nowhere in the picture whatsoever, unfortunately. Oh. So, but, you know, so he played a sissy, but it's somewhere on the cutting room floor. Now, if I can just deviate for a moment. We have a documentary that I did with Leo Evans, who did Cafe Purgatory with me, that you were kind enough to show at the 1999 Fort Worth Film Festival.
Yeah.
And which actually won the Crowd Pleaser Award. I'm still wearing my my jeans jacket I got out of that deal.
That's what it's made for.
Oh, man. And Bill was a fascinating character, as you know. And we did 30-minute documentary. And Joey, our producer here, Joey Hambrick, is getting ready to put it on streaming on Amazon. As a matter of fact, when this comes out, it should already be streaming on Amazon. And what'd you say? You figure $2? Is that what it's going to cost for somebody to have it for 24 hours? And so I would recommend anyone who's a Bill Boyce fan within the sound of our voice who would like to see a documentary about him called Bill Boyce Money Actor, which I wrote and co-produced. and appear in would go to Amazon. And what do you have to do, Joey? You have any idea? Just have to say you want it, and there you go.
I think so.
Okay,
yeah,
good. I hope so.
You would order anything from Amazon.
Okay,
stream
yeah.
It on your television.
Just stream it on your television, and it's called Bill Bush Money Actor. And it's just now, after all these years, it had some film festival showings and some theatrical showings, but it's just now hitting the mass market. So if you'd like to see that, $2, gamble $2 and see what you think, and please let us know. That's the end of the plug, and now back to our regularly scheduled program with Rat Fink. And for those who don't know, it's just recently been discovered, and Schuyler Hayden, who got the money together for this picture by apparently mortgaging his house, he came from oil money up in Denver, and apparently he had, if you watch the extras on the DVD, his daughter said his mother had committed suicide when he was very young, and he always blamed his father for it, and they were high society in Denver. Well, when he made Rat Fink, that pretty well took care of all of that, because it was scandalous. It was an absolute scandal in his family and in that circle. So it's basically Schuyler Hayden is this guy who becomes, who's just this amoral sort of drifter that becomes a rock and roll star by, you know, it's the classic thing of stepping on people on the way up. But when he steps on them, he doesn't just step on them. He just twists his heel into their faces. He's a terrible, ugly, irredeemable character.
Oh, burns him to death in one case.
That's exactly right. Absolutely burns him to death, and takes their money. He gets in their confidence and then takes their money. And it's Schuyler Hayden is pretty doggone good in this picture.
Oh, he's arresting performance, just powerful. And why did this happen? The Variety Review raves about it, the trade paper.
And raves about his performance, right?
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And the idea of Landis continuing the confrontational approach that he had handled so well in The Sadist, the idea of somebody pointing the way toward a greater maturity of subject matter in film, gosh, what were they thinking? They were so far ahead of the game that they couldn't help but come in last.
And it really never got an audience, did it?
No. Even The Sadist found an audience once they hit the drive-ins.
Right. But this would have been a great drive-in picture. I have no idea why it never connected. It's a very intense, it's a very personal picture.
Yeah.
It's a very powerful picture in a lot of ways.
Oh, yeah. You see influence reaching all the way into the present day. There's a lot of that in even the current work of David Lynch, certainly in a picture of Lynch's from 1990 called Wild at Heart. You see this is what rock and roll as a class, as an idiom, a pop music idiom, had been pretty well emasculated by 1960.
Yes.
This takes it back to a dangerous state.
Pre-Dick Clark and Bobby Philly.
Right.
State, right, yes.
Right,
uh-huh.
Exactly.
More rock and roll.
All due respect to our friends like Frankie Avalon,
sure,
but they weren't rocking. But Frankie and his general kind were more throwbacks to Sinatra,
yes,
than they were rock and rollers.
They were crooners, weren't they? Really,
crooners, exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there's room for everybody, but once the Brill Building or Tin Pan Alley got a hold of rock and roll, things weren't the same after that.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's exactly right. And this is not a Brill Building thing at all.
No.
This is way different. We should say that Vilmos Zsigmond is the camera operator here, the director of photography, rather.
Oh, I'll tell you what, you can see his big time coming right there on the screen in Rat Fink.
You sure can, can't you? And honestly, I mean, you kind of wonder after seeing this and some of the other things, even with what he was saddled with, low budgets and in some cases Arch Hall Jr., who was not necessarily the greatest thespian that ever walked the face of the earth. And you see what he makes out of all of that. And you see what he makes out of Rat Fink, which is a sincere movie. That may be an odd adjective to use, but it's a very sincere picture.
Oh yeah, it's with Arch Hall, Landis somehow connected player and role ideally.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Difficult to think of Arch Hall Jr. as being an actor,
right.
Although he, he probably would have fit into the Beach Party picture.
He would have been fine. He would have been good in the Jody McCrae part, right?
And he remains. He is still a very good guitarist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the accidental combination of that psychopathic role in The Sadist and what Arch Hall was unbeknownst to himself, capable of doing.
Mm-hmm.
My gosh. Okay, there's your genetic template for Badlands,
mm-hmm.
Terrence
mm-hmm.
Malick's picture. There's your genetic template for Natural Born Killers.
Mm-hmm.
And in Rat Fink, just such a short time later, here's your genetic template for a whole lot of anti-hero pictures.
Rock and roll pictures, anti-hero rock and roll pictures, right?
Anti-hero rock and roll pictures that also work on the level of film noir.
What would Rat Fink have played? What kinds of theaters, Michael?
They tried it in the mainstream theaters. I've seen photographs of some elaborate Hollywood Boulevard billboards.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, no, I don't think that's the audience. You know, it's just too darn bad they didn't connect with a good old exploitation outfit like Sony Amusements.
Right, right. But then they'd have probably had to put some stock footage of, like, natives or something in them, right?
Probably some grindhouse elements.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's certainly not a grindhouse picture. It's the kind of picture, I keep going back to David Lynch. It's the kind of picture that David Lynch and the Coen brothers have been doing since the 1980s.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What would you describe the elements? How would you describe those elements, the elements they have in common?
Random misfortune.
Okay. Which is very much film noir, of course.
Very much. It's uh-huh. like anything can happen to anybody at any moment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there is the essence of this picture and Edgar Ulmer's 1945 film Detour.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Pictures that pivot, not coincidentally, I'm sure, on leading men who are not that admirable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In Detour, you've got the Tom Neal, weak-willed, easily manipulated schlub.
Right.
In Rat Fink, you've got the manipulating schlub,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
who really isn't worth listening to, but people can't resist.
You know, it kind of makes me wonder, and I just now thought about this, if that whole kind of idea is also what fuels the slasher pictures. The idea of just the people are, you know, there's not a lot of a lot of big moral leads in those. They're just people who happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Mm-hmm.
They happen to be at Crystal Lake when Jason climbs out, and sometimes they happen to be having sex, or they happen to be, you know, that's what usually happens, that have sex.
Oh, yeah, in self-indulgence. The Friday the 13th pictures are alarmingly puritanical.
They are, and really Halloween started out that way, too.
Very. Oh, yeah, yeah. The difference being that Halloween is comparatively more subtle.
Right.
And builds more tension than is suspense. But yeah, there's an element of, and I kind of doubt that's what they were shooting for, but it's the greater point is, what's the most vulnerable position you could find yourself
mm-hmm.
in?
Exactly.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
And so that Rat Fink is too intelligent to be connected with the slasher pictures,
mm-hmm.
although there's quite a bit of violent crime in it.
Mm-hmm.
It is a very suspenseful film, and you develop a kind of a forbidden sympathy with this character.
You do. Almost a there with the grace of God thing is what you really have.
Yeah, it's like you really
like
feel
that.
Yourself identifying with mm-hmm. this malicious jerk.
Right.
And, exactly. And then you catch yourself doing it and say, wait a minute, what am I thinking here? Well, you're following the lead of a very well written and extremely well played role.
Well, apparently what happened to Schuyler Hayden after that, of course he did Ride on Sunset Strip, which we did a couple of shows ago, a couple of podcasts
mm-hmm.
ago. And, you know, he's one of those guys, you look at him and you think, gosh, I've seen him before. And, of course, you hadn't, unless you'd seen Rat Fink, or, you know, he made a couple of small TV appearances. But apparently mm-hmm. Rat Fink drained all the money he had, but somehow he was still kind of a lease kid, and he took off and didn't do anything for about 20 years, according to his daughter. And then he decided to try and get back into movies, and that's when he had his plane crash in San Diego and died in the plane crash. He was really a star-crossed guy, and apparently, as I say, he really got on the outs with his dad and his dad's circle after making Rat Fink. I think it just kind of shocked them all. And but it's like a lot of those people who do that, a lot of those rebel kids who do that, and then it turns out that all they end up doing is really alienating everybody around them, and I guess that's what he did, and he was fed up and never made any money. And again, you get back to stuff like Stark Fear, which we did several podcasts ago, and all of the stuff where it's like writing in a way. You know, writing a book is easier than getting it distributed. And, you know, and it's the same thing with a movie. I mean, making a movie, as hard as it is probably not as hard as getting it distributed with a legitimate distributor. And I don't think Schuyler Hayden ever had that.
Didn't have the distribution, didn't have the marketing savvy, just had a hell of a good story to tell.
Yeah.
And told it to the best of everybody's ability. I mean, that's the art direction, the photography, certainly the writing, tense, involving direction, everything works about this picture.
Yeah.
Except the marketing campaign.
Except it couldn't connect it to the people. That's right. And that was a little bit like Private Property, right? Wasn't that pretty much the same thing with Private Property?
Pretty much the same thing, and a similarly controversial topic.
Right, and similarly dark sort of vision, I think.
Oh, yeah.
With the characters, you know, with the lead characters. And yeah, because the lead characters really in Private Property, the leads are reprehensible, or at least, I mean, both the leads are, because the
all
husband.
All three of them.
Yeah, well, yeah. Really, all three
yeah.
of them. You're right. You're exactly right. The two men and the woman. That's right. But there's nobody that's very... that is very likable in Rat Fink, and even the teenager that he impregnates in the pool in that very strange sequence, when he takes her to get an abortion at the veterinary clinic, which is just over the top that you're just you're wondering what it is. That's an incredible, to me, that sequence is the toughest sequence in the whole picture.
No, it's a challenge. Not the sort of thing to approach cavalierly, but a film to relish. It's the honesty of it, the confrontational honesty at work here. You have your superficial confrontation, like in Blood Feast, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Where there's never really any emotional connection, just a pageant of how much more of this can you stand
exactly.
to watch?
Exactly.
Yeah. And that's all well and good, because that's what Herschel Lewis and David Friedman were aiming at.
Exactly.
just pushing
Landon Ames higher, Hayden Ames higher, and they get they bring the art of confrontation, not stopping at the visceral level, but taking it way deep into emotional territory
and very heavy psychological territory as well.
Yeah,
I guess this is just very recently in the past year or so been unearthed somewhere. And
very recent, the Blu-ray restoration is just about as good as it gets.
Yeah. So it's really, in many ways, a terrific picture. It's very tough in some cases to watch because it puts you in the, as people say about some of the films noir, it puts you in the shoes of a heel and makes you like it. And in this case, in Schuyler, Hayden is just another, you know, Michael, you and I have both made a living writing for most of our lives, and we both know that it's not just about talent. It's about timing. It's about, you reach a certain level, and it's about timing, it's about luck, it's about any number of factors that are completely out of your control, and they're out of Schuyler Hayden's control. You know, my little conceit has always been that those of us who create have our own little tight orbits we're going around in, around the Earth. And for some reason, if you're good enough to do that and create that, then as the Earth moves, at some point, it intersects with some of these little orbits. And you become famous, or you become well-read, or your movie becomes a hit. But it's out of your control. All you can do is just send it up there to orbit. And then
you just keep on keeping on.
What else can you do? That's right. And speaking of that, tell me what you've got out on the market right now that the folks might want to take a look at on Amazon.com.
Well, we're getting a really good reception on Amazon for the Forgotten Horrors Reader.
Good.
That's the latest in the series. Yes. Technically, I guess it'd be volume 11.
I guess. I sent you my thoughts on that the other day. It's a beautiful piece. It's just a wonderful book.
It worked. It fell together pretty well. It gets back into print the long out of print manuscript for Human Monsters, which was George Turner's and My Villain book.
Plus, you've beefed that up a little bit too with that extra Karloff material and stuff.
Oh yeah, mm-hmm. Beefed up to an alarming extent, and has that wonderful quote from Karloff, which he gave when we did the interview in 1968 about how I really don't think of these as a Mad Doctor series. I leave that to you, eggheads. And, you know, he was just making pictures.
Right.
A lot of coincidences there. But Phil Hardy had remarked on the so-called Mad Doctor pictures that Karloff did at Columbia. A string of kindly old scientists whose experiments go horribly awry.
Mm-hmm. Sounds very British, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, Phil Hardy was his encyclopedia of horror movies and George's and my original Forgotten Horrors intersected at many points, and we always compared notes. Phil died a couple of years ago, and he's a terrible loss to the community.
He was a Brit, though, was he not?
Oh yeah, very English. He was the one who likened the creatures in Day of the Triffids to ambulatory broccoli.
Well, the Forgotten Horrors reader, when you put that together. What was the purpose to get to just kind of bring a lot of this together that haven't been printed for a while or hadn't ever
the original
printed?
The original idea was to do a restoration of the Human Monsters manuscript with the amendments that George and I had intended all along, and omitting a lot of the unfortunate mis-editing that the 1995 publisher had imposed.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And to create an index, you know, I mean, what do you mean putting this book out without an index? Well, we'll fix that.
Right.
But the secondary concern was I unearthed these research papers for the University of North Texas that my wife, Christina, had done in 1990, and I helped out a little bit on that with research and and what have you, and found the stash of classroom papers from the film studies program and got to reading through them. I said, wow, this is pretty good. And then there was a note from one of the professors at the top of one paper says, you should publish this. It's like, okay, I think I will.
Yeah. There's some really nice Val Lewton stuff in there, I remember. And
can't go wrong writing about Val Lewton.
No, you sure can't.
His stuff enchants and mystifies. No matter how much it's explained or over-intellectualized, it all holds up beautifully well. And that's a lot of fun. Actually, what working on right now is a new volume of Deep in the Horrors of Texas, containing some restorations from our old pal Jack Jackson.
Good. Excellent.
The late Jack Jackson. Mm-hmm. Who often lamented that he wished he had had a Leroy lettering machine when he was doing those EC tribute stories.
Right.
And I said, well, you know, maybe we can do something about that one of these days.
Uh-huh.
But Jack and I worked together during the early 90s at the Texas A&M University Press doing historical books.
But the stuff you're talking about, he did for Slow Death and people like that, right?
Slow Death for Skull and Slow Death and what have you. Mm-hmm. And unlike so many successful academics, as he had become, he did not feel the least bit embarrassed by his underground comics work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I've seen a lot of them who go mainstream and say, oh, don't look at those. Those are primitive. Jack was very proud of it. And having come into possession of much of his original art from that period, it's like I'm just flabbergasted to see how much detail was lost in that cheap original printing process.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so it's like now we're in a position to do something about it. And we lost Jack, 11 years ago.
I think it's 11 years ago.
I like to think that he might be having some fun watching the restorations from a distance.
I certainly hope so. I wouldn't be a bit surprised.
The other big thing is I finally got a tribute album started.
Good.
Everybody wants to do a tribute album.
Yeah, you doing yours
Ray too. Benson did. Ray Benson did the Bob Wills.
Yeah, did
and
a
all.
Couple
I mean,
of them. Yeah,
exactly. A lot of things like that going on. I said, "What the hell? Let's do a Floyd Kramer tribute album."
Really?
Nice. So I'm writing new material in that style. You know that what George Turner used to call 3D piano.
Bent notes. The bent notes.
The bent notes, mm-hmm. the little grace note at the start of each phrase.
Right.
And I'm going to avoid remakes. I figure let's get some stuff Floyd never touched and see how well it adapts.
I think that's a great idea. What kind of stuff are you doing?
I've rewritten On the Rebound, one of his
mm-hmm.
big hits,
mm-hmm.
With a very imaginative title. It's called On the Rebound Again.
Mm-hmm.
but changed the chord. Kept the structure, changed the chords.
Right. Okay.
It's like it's real, but it never happened.
Mm-hmm.
And then a lot of Angelo Badalamenti, the musical scoring master for David Lynch,
mm-hmm.
translates well to that style.
I'm curious, how would samba music translate to that style?
Oh, beautifully well.
One note samba or desafinado or something like that. I'm wondering, I don't know that he ever recorded those types of songs.
No, although there was a Latinate influence in a lot of Floyd's playing.
Yes, there was.
And
absolutely.
Yes, I mean he would have been ideal for the girl from Ipanema.
Right.
Or practically any boss. The real stretch right now, I'm not certain it's going to work to suit everybody including me, but Dylan's Just Like Tom Thumb's Blues.
I don't know. I can see.
Anyway, we're going to call the album Just Like Floyd Kramer's Blues, approximately.
Nice. Very. When's that going to be out, do you think?
Well, it's in pre-production right now. I've got most of the arrangements at least roughed out, and probably start recording as soon as things calm down after September.
Right. Very good. Well, we want on our end here, Joey and I want to once again hammer home Bill Boyce Money Actor. that's going to be streaming on Amazon by the time you hear this. We'd like for you to take a look at it and consider plunking down two frog skins and giving it a look and telling us what you think. Michael, thank you, and we'll be back again before you know it.
I will be looking forward to that.
Me too.